All right. Yeah, thanks for the nice introduction, Emily. And also, of course, thanks for the invitation here to Perimeter. I had a pretty good time so far. Now I'm happy to talk about my work that I've been doing in the recent years in the context of spin polarized Fermi gases. And this is work that I've been doing in collaboration with my advisor, Jens Braun von TU Darmstadt, and also a student in the group, Florian Ehmann, and in close collaboration with the group at UNC Chapel Hill of Joaquin Drute, and of course with Andrew Lowiak and Casey Berger, who is also here today. So let me start with the most basic question: why should we even be interested in Fermi gases at all? And well, the short and simple answer is they're all over the place. We can think of many examples, right? For instance, nuclear physics, where we have protons and neutrons that are fermions and interact with a very complicated potential. So we have a very challenging fermionic many-body problem. Or a somewhat different example would be neutron stars, where we have a lot of neutrons packed together quite tightly. And this is often connected also to the so-called unitary Fermi gas, which I will explain in just a bit. A yet different example would be the theory of the strong interaction, quantum chromodynamics, where we have, say, quarks now as fermions, and their interplay leads to also very interesting effects in the QCD phase diagram. Maybe a more common example here would be electrons in metal. We have a Fermi gas that is responsible for everyday properties, right? We have a material, and we can say if it is a conductor or an insulator, and these are properties of this Fermi gas here, or if it does more fancy things, such as superconductivity at very low temperatures. So clearly, there's a lot of different things going on where fermions are the important degree of freedom. And we can think of many more, and we all, I guess, are working in some way or the other to understand the behavior of these systems. But I want to point out one very special opportunity that people have realized in the well, past decades, I guess. And this is taking on this project, a problem from a somewhat different angle. So rather than looking at a system that we find in nature, we just realize that we can build these things in the lab. And this is exactly what people are doing in a lot of so-called cold atom experiments around the world. So this is my rendition of laser cooling right here. And the basic idea of such a cold atom experiment is you take a dilute gas of atoms and cool it down to very low temperatures, say nanokelvin, for instance. And then we basically switch off thermal fluctuations and are able to control in a very precise manner these quantum many-body effects that we're interested in. So these experiments come in a large variety of systems. One could have optical lattices or bosonic systems, or we can also do Fermi gases. And what this might look like, I have here on the slide, it's a bunch of up and down fermions, or red and blue, or however you want to call it, actually. And what's done in experiment is it's typically two different hyperfine states of some fermionic atom species. Most notably, I guess, lithium-6 and potassium-40 due to their favorable properties in experiment. And now, as I said, experimentists have achieved a way to control physical parameters of these systems very precisely. And most notably, they can control the scattering length. Here, I've written as AS. I guess you don't see the pointer really here. And the scattering length is responsible for the interaction between those particles, right? So we can tune with a mechanism that's called the Feshbach resonance. I will not explain it in detail here. The scattering length by tuning an external magnetic field. And this can be done in a quite precise way. And with this tool at hand, we can think of a bunch of different scenarios we can play now. For instance, we could tune the interaction so that there's weak attraction between up and down particles. And this is when these pairs form. These are called Cooper pairs. And of course, we know them from the theory of superconductivity. It's the so-called BCS regime. On the other hand, we can tune the interaction such that we end up with very tightly bound pairs of spin up and down particles. And this is then acting basically as a boson. So we have a gas of composite bosons that is weakly interacting. And at very low temperatures, this will then Bose-Einstein condensate. So this is the BEC, so Bose-Einstein condensation regime. So this is an interesting consequence. We started out with interacting fermions, although, and ended up with something that Bose-Einstein condenses. So this is this so-called BEC-BCS crossover. But right in the, so to say, middle of this crossover, there's this regime where the scattering length AS here is much larger than the particle spacing, which I've written here as in terms of the density, which in turn is much, much larger than the effective range of some potential. And what this is called the unitary regime or the unitary Fermi gas, and this is right at the Feshbach resonance, so at the divergence of this scattering length AS here.
Yeah? Are you looking at this in three dimensions?
This is now three-dimensional. I guess the unitary point for two and one dimension would be non-interacting. But this is in the three-dimensional case, yeah. Right. So this divergence of this scattering length now has some interesting consequences since we don't have it as a scale in our system anymore, and so it drops out from any description. And we end up with the fact that the density and the temperature are the only dimensionful scales in our system that dictate the physics. The consequence of this is that we can write our thermodynamic properties, say the energy or the pressure or anything else that we might encounter as a product of the non-interacting value with some dimensionless scaling function. These scaling functions are universal. They're universal in the sense that they don't depend on the microscopic interactions, microscopic details of the interactions, right? So what that means is it shouldn't matter if I conduct my experiment with lithium or potassium, I should still measure the same scaling function Fe or Fp here. And this is, in fact, exactly what has been observed in a large number of experiments. I've just listed a few here, I guess from the first realizations of the unitary fermions, like roughly 15 years ago, to ones that just came out, were put on the archive 2 weeks ago, or like the trans contact was measured, which is a very important many-body quantity. So there's a lot of experimental and also theoretical interest in this interesting system. So most of the insights we have gained have been for the balanced case, where we have an equal amount of spin up and down particles. But of course, one can ask the question, what happens as soon as we turn on spin polarization? So when we have more of the one species than we do have the other, how does pairing, for instance, work in this case? Because not every partner has now a particle to pair up with and things like that. So there's some insights on that, but it's of course much more challenging from a theoretical perspective, as I will point out in just a bit. But this is just the system that I'm interested in. So that's the plan. We want to have an ab initio treatment of imbalanced Fermi gases. And to address these systems, we have to answer a bunch of key questions. First of all, can we construct a method that is able to deal with that sort of system efficiently? And then on the physical side, what can we learn? Can we get equations of state, or what can we learn about the phase diagram of these systems? All right, so this is the plan for today. Let me start with the first part. It's about the method and how we construct it. And for that, I want to introduce the concept of stochastic quantization. Let's remind ourselves what we are interested in. We have here the partition function, which is just written as a path integral over some field phi. How it precisely looks like doesn't matter for now. It's just written as here as the integral over the Boltzmann weight. And what we're interested in are answers to questions we might ask in terms of expectation values of operators. And we can write these expectation values just as an integral, a weighted integral, basically. And it's weighted with this probability measure P here, which is just the Boltzmann weight normalized by the partition function. So this is what we typically do. And now, so this is what Euclidean field theory would look like. And now the basic idea that Parisi and Wu had in the 80s was that this probability measure that we're looking for, so this d-dimensional probability measure, is just the equilibrium distribution of some fictitious random process in d plus one dimensions. This is the basic idea what they put forward. And in fact, this can be shown rigorously for a real field phi here. It might sound a bit weird, so let's look at which equation describes this random process. And we might remember that when it's a Langevin equation. We might remember that from Brownian motion. When we look in the microscope and we have a dust particle in a liquid, we only see the dust particle and it seems to perform this random movement. And because the particles in the liquid are too little to observe, and they kind of have this fluctuating force input. And this is exactly what's written here in this stochastic differential equation. We have here the change of our field phi here with this fictitious Blanche event time, it's not the physical time, is the drift term. So this is the the thing that kind of contains our physics, that's the action, and a random force term, or I also call it noise term. And in order to get the right dynamics, this noise term has to obey some properties. Of course, it has to be centered at zero. It shouldn't have any autocorrelation. This is this delta function there. And the factor of two is set by the dissipation fluctuation theorem. So that's the equation that we are using to basically interpret our path integral now. And it still might look a bit weird, but we can think about this equation a bit more. Let us first disregard this noise term. Then we just say this noise term is zero, and then we have a deterministic equation. And what this would look like is basically a gradient descent, and we would end up with a classical solution of the action here. We would end up at the minimum of the action. So this is a stationary point. And if we now add in back the noise term, we just have a classical solution and fluctuations around it. So this is a quite explicit way of kind of quantization that this noise term are our quantum fluctuations. Okay, so that's the idea that we want to use. The question is, of course, how can we get the numerical method with this idea? And for that, we just discretize this equation. So we take here again the continuous form, integrate it on both sides for a certain time delta tau here, and then we shuffle it around. And then in this middle line here, we have an equation that produces from a random state phi n a next state phi n plus 1 according to some prescription. So what we end up with for the expert is a Markov chain Monte Carlo method. And we can just treat it as a regular Monte Carlo style evaluation. So we have a chain of samples. So we start somewhere, end up with after some time with a sequence, and we average those as it is written in the last line here to get expectation values of our observables. And these values of phi here will then be distributed according to the probability distribution that we were looking for in our path integral. So that's the main idea. That's the straightforward idea how to build a numerical method with stochastic quantization. So now, in order to shed some light on that, I prepared everyone's favorite example, the harmonic oscillator. Everybody knows it. We have here the action as with an integral over the Euclidean time. And as an additional complication, so to say, we have now to discretize this Euclidean time into n tau time slices. So we just chop it up into chunks of delta tau. And then we, instead of having this integral, we have a sum now. Of course, now our quantum field phi is now the coordinate x. And what we would end up here to stay in QFT language, we had a 0 plus 1 dimensional field theory, so to say, as our toy problem that we can address with this method. We just take this action and plug it into our Langevin equation. And then we have this form here in a discrete version. And since we now have multiple values of x or multiple degrees of freedom for every temporal lattice site, we end up with a couple set of stochastic differential equations. This we can solve by iterating. Of course, to see if we're doing the right thing, we can calculate the energy just by taking the expectation value of the square of x. Or we can also get the square of the wave function by checking the last line here, and we just see that it's basically the histogram of our sampled x values. All right, so what that might look like, I have prepared a little animation for you. Here on the lower left, I have the spatial degree of freedom here as x, and the gray shaded area is the harmonic confinement. This is not to scale, this is just to show what's going on. And this red dashed line is the exact ground state square of the wave function for the harmonic oscillator, which is nothing else but a Gaussian. And on top of that, this is an interesting to see. This is basically one path in our path integral. We see here that the Langevin time is zero. So this is just the initial configuration. And we then use the Langevin time to kind of sample different paths in this integral. So we have here the imaginary time axis and again the the same spatial axis. So this is exactly living in this potential in here. So if I let this evolve now, we get different paths. So one path here, one wiggly line, corresponds to one energy here on this plot. The energy is just measured as I told you before. And for every contribution in the path integral, we measure one point, and then we average it. and we start averaging after some warm-up time. So this is really just the way as one would do in a regular Monte Carlo approach. So we can continue. So now we see it started to average. Also, the square of the wave function started to update, and it's doing its thing. It's wiggling, and we see, of course, the error of our measurement here, that the red error bar gets smaller as the time progresses. This is because we end up with more samples after more Langevin time. So the Langevin time here would correspond to a sample number in a regular Monte Carlo type calculation. After some time that we are satisfied with our size of the error bar, we just stop the simulation and we see that we have a nice agreement with the expected answer. All right, so that's the quick stochastic quantization in a nutshell idea. That's it for the method. Just to quickly recap, we have a way of interpreting these Euclidean field theories as a limit of a stochastic random process, which we can then use to construct a numerical method. And well, this method is at least capable of solving the harmonic oscillator. So this is a first win. But now the question is, of course, what can this method do for me if I'm interested in fermions? Yes?
Can you extend this to a case where action is imaginary or complex?
That's exactly where I'm going right now. So in two slides, I will answer your question. This is the plan. This is the whole reason why we want to do this. So let me first go on, and then maybe if your question is still unanswered, I'll answer it. So fermions. So that was the thing that we are interested in. And let me clarify what I mean when I talk about fermions. So we are considering this model here. We have in the first line a kinetic part. It's just a quadratic dispersion. And then in the second line, we have a contact interaction with the interaction strength G. And this is justified for to describe these cold atom systems in the limit where we have a particle spacing that is much larger than the effective range R0 of our potential here. So this particle spacing is just the inverse of the Fermi wave vector here. So then we can safely assume a contact interaction between the particles. So keeping this model in mind, we are again interested in partition function and expectation values. Now we can just write this as a trace of over our density operator. And we already see that we have now e to the minus beta t plus v. And we have the t is the kinetic operator, one-body operator, and the v is a two-body operator. And well, I guess we all know it's kind of challenging to deal with this. Generally, there's many methods and approximations to do that. The way we do it, I won't go into all the details. I will just give you the basic recipe. And it's the basic recipe of something called auxiliary field methods. So what we do is we put the system on a lattice. So we discretize the spatial coordinate. And we perform a Trotter decomposition. So we also discretize the imaginary time. So we end up with our system living on a space-time lattice. And in order to deal with the two-body operator here, the interaction operator, we perform a Haber-Zoltanowicz transformation. So we decouple the interaction, and we end up with this path integral-like form here in the lower line. If you want to check out the details, there's a bunch of reviews on that. And it's a fairly common way to deal with the interaction. Actually, the auxiliary field method has been used in quantum chemistry and condensed matter and lattice field theory. So there's a lot of that.
Are you fixing the number of fragments that you have?
Well, it's written in a general way here. You could work in the canonical ensemble or in the grand canonical ensemble. It doesn't matter. Actually, for the ground state calculation I'm going to show you, then this would end up being a projective approach. So you project to the ground state, and there you typically fix the particle numbers. If you work at finite temperature, you would most likely work in the grand canonical ensemble where you fix chemical potentials.
Okay. So you're not going to have a Fermi surface here as your ground state or your Fermi gas state?
Well, in the ground state, you would have a Fermi surface, right? You stack up your single particle basis from below. So you start out with the non-interacting one, and this is basically the Fermi surface. And I guess it depends on if you have a Fermi surface or not, depending on your temperature in the system that you put in the grand canonical ensemble. But yeah, it's a very, it depends on what you're looking at. It can be done either way. But yeah, so what we end up with is this integral down here. But you can now ask the question, well, what is this good for? We have a complicated trace, and now we have an extremely complicated integral. I mean, this integral is very high dimensional. It can be some 100,000 dimension, depending on the problem. So this is certainly not analytically computable. But if you look closely here on this last equality, it looks exactly like the integral we had before. So the hope is that we can do something about it. And this is exactly what the idea is. So we use this path integral we wrote down and plug it into our Langevin equation. This is exactly how we deal with fermions with this method. And of course, we had the question already. If we look closely, and I've written in it such a way that it's quite obvious, we have here in the integrand our determinants over some matrix, one for the up and one for the down. Flavor can be written for any number of flavor, but it already is here. So these quantities could in principle be negative. And these are actually negative in the cases where we have different particles for spin up and down, or different chemical potentials, or different masses, or in our case, also a repulsive interaction. So all the systems that are called interesting before. So we need to do something about it. And the question was connected to the case if we can deal with a complex action, because if this probability measure here is negative, this means that the action must be complex, because e to the something real is always positive. So we end up with a complex action. Now, the good thing is, so this is what we call the sign problem in regular Monte Carlo approaches. Now, the idea is, and this is the reason why we bother with all this stochastic quantization business, is that we extend this approach to complex action by considering a complex auxiliary field. So instead of having a real auxiliary field, we have a complex one, and we end up with a complex Langevin equation. Since now, of course, when the action is complex, also the drift in general will be complex, and we kind of split this up into two pieces. So this is the way one would hope to get around the sign problem. And I am not claiming that this is a general solution to the sign problem. In fact, I'm going to come to that later. But the idea has been around for a while. A few years.
Question.
Yes?
So here, the way that you wrote down the determinant, you are assuming that the G component of spin is the conserve.
Yes.
That this usual way of doing a determinant Monte Carlo.
Exactly. This is exactly the way how you would do an AFQC.
So, but if you can generalize this to the other case, then can you deal with the situation where spin is not conserved?
Yeah, one would have to decouple the interaction term then in the pairing channel, for instance. I think it could be done. We have
principle can do it.
If it can be done with and written down in a quadratic form of the in the Hamiltonian, like in the quadratic form of the Fermion operators, I'm pretty sure it can be done. It depends on the problem itself. I'm going to come that. So it's not always well defined. I'll comment on that in just a bit. But I would say that it's possible that one could at least write it down and try that. So there's no principal roadblock. But yeah, so this idea, this is the idea how to get around this bad computational scaling with the sign problem.
So, question? So what is the statement? Is the statement that equilibrium distribution of that complex Langevin equation gives the average over that distribution gives the
yes.
desired average?
Exactly. That's the idea.
Is that something you can prove?
No, that's the problem. So if we could prove it, then the sign problem would be solved.
Okay.
So in general, I guess then you get a lot of prizes and whatever recognition. So that's why I explicitly say I'm not claiming to solve the sign problem, but it has been shown, actually there's the next slide, that the CL converges to a wrong limit. And this has to do, if we want to write down that the derivation, one has to show that there's boundary terms that need to vanish. And this has to do, so one goes from a Fokker-Planck type equation, so to describe the temporal evolution of the probability distribution to a Langevin equation, and one would require the boundary terms to vanish. And it is pretty challenging or impossible to show rigorously. But it turns out that one can write down some conditions to ensure that this approach is valid. So people have worked on it for quite a while. Gert Arts and co-workers are quite well known for that. So they, it comes from the idea of, or from the area of lattice QCD. They worked on that, and they used these approaches to deal with lattice QCD at finite temperature, at finite density, for instance. And it's the problem is, of course, since we cannot rigorously show it before we do the calculation, there could still go something could still go wrong. It has been shown. So this, and there's a bunch of paper with the titles complex Langevin, when can it be trusted, or is it a numerical method and stuff like that. So there has been some dispute in the past, and there's still to some extent. But what one can do is one can perform the simulation and then carefully check what's going on. There's a bunch of markers that we have that we need to satisfy, and if this is satisfied and benchmarked versus known results, and this is really what one should do, then one can be relatively sure that we end up with something meaningful. But it's
some general conditions under which this approach actually works.
Yeah, one could write down observables that are constructed so that they are sensitive to these boundary terms, and then if those are violated, then one can see that this, even if it looks converged, that this would probably be spurious results. There's a nice paper by Arts and coworkers, the 17th one. I can point to the reference later. But yeah, in general, so there are some markers that one can use to check if this is really meaningful that comes out of this calculation. Yeah, as I said, benchmarking is extremely important in that case. And in the spirit of benchmarking, I want to start with some results for one-dimensional systems. Of course, they're computationally much cheaper than 2D or 3D systems. And of course, there are also exact solutions available by Beta-Ansatz for the model that we're looking. So we have excellent benchmark systems. And even so, the physics are nowadays very interesting because there's also experimental interest now in 1D systems. So let me start with the most straightforward scenario. We have here a balanced case. So we have the ground state energy. So this is now in the ground state at zero temperature, the ground state energy as a function of the interaction strength gamma here. That's the dimensionless interaction divided by, so G divided by the density. And we have 5 up plus 5 down particles at a periodic ring. And what we see here is in blue our CL values agree with all the values that are taken from other methods. There's Beta-Ansatz solutions, they're in the thermodynamic limit, and also HMC solutions, so hybrid Monte Carlo solutions on the attractive side because there's no sign problem in the balanced case. And we see it generally agrees quite nicely. There's some discrepancy here, but this is due to the fact that the HMC values are extrapolated to large lattices and the CL are not. But this can be done, and then there's actually some good agreement. So this looks nice, but doing more checks, we can see on the repulsive side, our distribution looks like this. And this is bad because these outliers with respect to what would be a Gaussian here at gamma of 3 can kind of bias our expectation value, and then we cannot trust our values again. So this is one of the issues that arises when the simulation doesn't work. Well, luckily, we're interested in the attractive side. We want to know about pairing of fermions, and there's no issue. So we always, on any simulation we have performed so far on the attractive side, we've seen very nice behavior. All right, so that's the balanced case. We can now introduce a case where we would have a sign problem. This is with a finite mass imbalance. We describe this by m bar, which is just m up minus m down divided by the total mass. And on the left, we see these are actual plots that are taken from a paper by Shailesh Chandrasekaran's group at Duke, which came out at the end of last year. And we see here again the ground state energy as a function of gamma. And there is some deviation going on here around gamma 3. And this is, of course, related to the fact that there's these fat tails going on. So this is really where the method would have some issues. On the other hand, if we look at the right plot here, this is now at fixed interaction strength gamma of minus 3, so the case that we had before. Again, the ground state energy, but this time as a function of the mass imbalance. And we have an attractive interaction here, and we see there's a very nice agreement with the Wurm algorithm they used in their paper and the CL and another HMC-based method that we used to address this system. So on the attractive side, again, we are in a good shape and we can get values that compare quite well. Right, so the last one, the system I want to consider today is the spin polarized one. So we fix our spin polarization here to 0.5. The polarization is given by n up minus n down, again divided by the total particle number. And again, ground state energy as a function of gamma here. This is for attractive systems. And we compare to the beta ansatz in the thermodynamic limit, and we see there's a very nice agreement as we decrease the density. This is, if you decrease the density, we would end up at a zero range limit, and this is exactly where we converge to. There's a very nice agreement also at finite polarization where one otherwise would have a sign problem. In fact, we did a lot more for 1D systems. I don't want to spend too much time on that. So there's Joaquin and Andrew did some of at finite temperature, which had also very nice agreement. We had the mass imbalance study. And now we're working on looking at correlation functions to study actually pairing in these systems. So we look at the pair distribution function and to look for like this off-center peak that would indicate an FFLO type pairing, which is in the works right now. But that's it for 1D. I want to go on to the thing I advertised before, the unitary Fermi gas in 3D. And of course, this is computationally much more challenging. We have now moved from the ground state to finite temperature description, and also from 1D to 3D. So there's a lot more computer time that goes into that, but it's still feasible. It's not unreasonable effort. And just to remind ourselves what we are looking at now, we again look at the partition function that we write as the trace, and we have now our chemical potential terms from mu up and mu down. And the way I write it is in terms of the average chemical potential mu and the effective magnetic field H, which is just the difference of the chemical potential. So the physics that we are interested in are recorded in these phase diagrams. These are two ways of looking at the same thing. Again, on the left here, we have temperature versus polarization. And this is a phase diagram that has been obtained by experiment in, I think, 2008 by Wolfgang Ketteler's group. So these are those 6 points of measurement. And then I think a line was fitted through. And this is then the phase transition between superfluid and normal phase. So what's going on here is if you look at a given temperature, we are in the superfluid phase. And we turn on the polarization. And at some point, the polarization is more than the superfluidity can endure, and it breaks down into a normal fluid again. This is what's called the so-called Chandrasekhar-Clogston limit. So we have a critical polarization at a given temperature. There's some knowledge here in the balanced case on the transition temperature. This has also been measured by experimentalists in Martin Zwierland's group in 2012. This is very precise. The transition temperature is roughly 0.17 Fermi. I think 0.167 is the precise value. And there's also some knowledge here on this critical polarization in the ground state that is obtained by diffusion Monte Carlo. So that's not quite without assumptions, but I think it's a pretty reasonable value. And on the other hand, so this is, again, temperature versus polarization. And now we can have temperature versus spin asymmetry. So this is the one that I'm actually going to focus on. So we have, again, our variables mu and h, and this is the one we have temperature in units of mu versus h in units of mu. So the idea is the same. We have a superfluid phase, and we have on top of that or above it a normal phase. And this pseudogap phase in the middle we can disregard for now. I just want to comment on that a little bit later. And to give you, yes?
So in the presence of polarization, what is the nature of the superfluid state in the zero temperature limit?
Yeah, that's the question. So in that study, they just have measured the transition temperature or the critical polarization, however one wants to interpret that. So there's not a lot of knowledge what's going on down here. And in fact, this is one of the things that we are looking for to see if there is some sort of inhomogeneous phase. There could be an FFLO type phase, so where there happens pairing between the particles, but it's not like in a BCS case where we would have finite zero center of mass momentum, but we would have a finite center of mass momentum. So this could be the case here. It's actually unknown, and this is something we want to address with this method. But the nature here, so the phase transition here, second order and first order, But the nature of the phase is, well, a PCS to a large extent, but it could be this homogeneous FFLO type phase.
But that will be like above the Chandrasekhar cluster level.
Yeah, it depends. There's not so much knowledge about that, but it's if anything, it's going to be here at very low temperatures and around this Chandrasekhar cluster level. That's right.
What exactly did they measure to pin down those points? Are they some thermodynamic quantity?
Yeah, they measured, so they were in the trap, and they measured when there's always a phase separation between the superfluid and the normal phase in the trap. And I think they measured when this transition point, and they did a local density approximation. So then with the LDA, they can then get the density dependence, and this is what they mapped to here
see. My question is simple. I was asking what exactly, how did they know if phase transition happened? What did they measure?
They looked at the point. So if you have a trap, a Fermi gas in a trap, the system will phase separate. There's a region where there's a superfluid core and normal wings, or vice versa. Depends on the dimension, I guess. And this point, they measured this point and then related it with an LDA to thermodynamic properties of the bulk.
So they saw phase separation.
Yes, they did. I guess they had some troubles because the error bars are quite large, and so there is some work to be done. That's the baseline here. We're going to focusing on thinking about this phase diagram in terms of this colorful lines here. If we fix a value of H, so we set a fixed value of the chemical potential asymmetry, we move along constant lines of beta H, and these are these lines here. So we started at high temperatures here somewhere, and then varying mu or beta mu just gives us, or larger beta mu values would decrease the temperature, and at some point we would hit the phase boundary. This is how we can think about it. Okay, again, let's start with the simpler case, although it's quite challenging already. This is the one of the main results here. This is the density equation of state. Here is the density of our system in units of the non-interacting density as a function of beta mu. So if we end up at large negative beta mu, we would go towards the classical regime where the thermal energy dominates, and increasing beta mu goes towards the quantum degenerate regime where the Fermi energy dominates. And what we see here is in blue our CL values, and they agree very nicely with everything that's on the plot. That's nice. So we have HMC values by Joaquin and co-workers from 2012. These are those yellow diamonds. Then we have also Bolt diagrammatic Monte Carlo method values that have been published, I think, along with the experimental values that are marked in red. So there's a lot of agreement going on across a wide temperature range here. We can actually look at this a bit more closely. Here at beta mu of 0, we see CL versus diagrammatic Monte Carlo. This is the same, basically, as the Bolt diagrammatic Monte Carlo, but they have updated values as of last year. So these are, I guess, newer values here, these dark diamonds. And we see a very nice agreement over here. This is within 1% of the experimental value, and the other one is, I think, within 4% of the experimental value. This is at beta mu of 0, and here we have beta mu of 2, which would correspond to a lower temperature. Now you could wonder, why do we have such a small error and why is it so far away from the experiment? This is because we don't include the systematic error in this error bar. This is only the statistical error. And I think the diagrammatic Monte Carlo values here include also some systematic error. Of course, the main contribution to our systematic error is the box size. And this is the reason why we have here at low temperatures, here at beta mu of 2 or 2.5, some issues, because this is the area where we run into the phase transition. And what happens physically is that if we lower the temperature, the thermal wavelength will become larger. At some point, it will be so large that it doesn't fit in our box anymore. And so we feel the box in our result. And this is where some problems come in. But it can, in principle, be fixed by performing runs at the larger box. The box size that we consider here is 11 cubed, so it's, I guess, intermediate size. There's room for improvement on that side. But the baseline here is that we do do a quite good job in the balanced case.
But is there a way to estimate systematic error?
Yes, one would have to do a more, I guess, straight, a more rigorous finite size scaling. We have done different sizes and saw that it didn't change much, but we didn't include it in the error bars. But one would have to do runs at different box sizes. So we have here 11 cubed, we can do 9 cubed, 7 cubed, 5 cubed, and then do an extrapolation. So one could estimate the systematic error from that. But they are not included in this error bars, this is what I'm saying. But there's in this regime, there's not a lot of dependence on the box size. Of course, if you hit this area, there's a lot of dependence because the thermal wavelengths will already be too large.
How are you sure that the distribution that you get represent the correct distribution?
Stochastic. Yes. Well, one would have to see the corresponding observables and look at the histograms for the values. A good sign for something goes wrong is when we have spikes. So when we have fat tails or outliers, as we have seen it, for instance, earlier. But I guess your question raises something more fundamental. I guess if you have a complex probability distribution, it's hard to show that there's only one probability. There could be multiple ones, actually. So I guess we didn't fully check that in that scenario, but we checked it versus other values that we got from other methods.
I guess when there are no other methods available.
Yes.
If you have only your results.
Yeah, you can believe it or you cannot believe it, I guess.
Yeah.
No, I mean, that is exactly what I'm saying. This is the reason why we have to do extensive benchmarks. So I guess there's if you have a sign problem, there's not so much that one could technically or generally do. So this is one way of doing something and say, OK, this looks reasonable. There seems to be no issues. This is our best bet at the moment. I mean, if we turn on spin imbalance, this is the only thing that we can do or that has been done so far that has like a quantitative aspect, right?
But can you make any judgment basically by looking at the converged Fokker-Planck distribution?
Yeah, we typically don't solve the Fokker-Planck, but we solve the Langevin equation because it's numerically much better.
But say if you can actually get a Fokker-Planck distribution.
Sorry, again, I didn't hear it.
If you actually get a Fokker-Planck distribution, the question is, by looking at this, can we tell whether it's a physical solution or not?
Yeah, but one would have a distribution for every degree of freedom, so for every spatial lattice site. But
as a matter of principle, imagine that.
I mean, yes, there are. We didn't check the distribution for the field values in this scenario, but one could or one can compute observables that are sensitive to those boundary terms. I don't have it at the top of my head how they would look like, but one can write it down and they would give a strong indication if there's something wrong or not. But of course, I mean, at some point we need to see if it works or not by comparing also to other methods. This is the best we can do for a large part. And we see it works quite nicely. The fundamental question remains if the values can be trusted in a setting where we don't have anything to compare with. But I will show you in just a bit that it actually looks quite reasonable. Something that I didn't mention yet is this dashed line on the high temperature area here. This is the viral expansion. And this has led to some confusion in the past, and this is why I want to spend a few words on that. So the idea of this expansion is that at high temperatures, the thermal wavelength is small, so the scattering cross-section will also be small, and we want to do a few-body cluster expansion. So we have here the quantity that we expand in is the fugacity C here, which is e to the beta mu. And if beta mu is large and negative, this is a small quantity and probably work out. And we can write, for instance, the log of the partition function as this series here. And this bn are then what's called the viral coefficients. To get those viral coefficients, one has to solve the nth coefficient. One has to solve the nth n-body problem. So the first one is just a non-interacting one-particle problem. The two-particle problem can be solved exactly. The three-body problem is quite well under control numerically. So the b B3 is quite well known for the unitary Fermi gas, but as soon as we go to B4, there is quite some dispute. So I will show the expansion only for to the third order. But we can also see that this, as soon as beta mu is zero, the fugacity, is one, and is not a small parameter anymore. So this is kind of the fundamental limit that we would expect where this expansion would be valid. And if we compare the values that we get from CL, again, here are the squares, order by order to the real expansion. On top, we have the balanced case. Of course, the dashed line is the non-interacting value. That's just flat one. Second order already approaches the CL, and the third order then does even a better job. So order by order, it gets better in this matching our results, which is a really strong indication that this does the right thing. On the other hand, we can also do this for polarized systems. So here, this is beta H of 2. This is the largest asymmetry we consider. And we can also see the same effect that is getting better with higher orders. Of course, it does deviate a bit earlier. So this is valid seemingly to -1, but here already at -2 is some divergence. But this is due to the fact that I have to now expand in two fugacities, one for the up and one for the down fermions. But the agreement is actually very nice. And it turns out that the agreement is nice for all the spin polarizations that we consider. So this is now our prediction for the spin polarized equation of state. It's the same plot as we had before, just that we now have the balanced case again in blue, and also systems at finite polarization. And we see the agreement is nice, and they continue to go smoothly. So this is the best bet that we have now. Of course, now we can also look at magnetic properties. Since we have spin up and down are not the same anymore, we can look at the magnetization, which is n up minus n down, or in a similar way, or the polarization, which is shown on the right, which is just the magnetization divided by the density, as we had before. This is bounded between 0 and 1. And we see here on the left, we have on the right, sorry, we have almost fully polarized system here at the low values of beta mu, and then going to higher values of beta mu, this gets suppressed as we would expect it. OK, so these are results for equation of states. And it's challenging to get more benchmark values for that, because there's nothing out there that does a quantitative, or not much out there, I guess, but does a quantitative job. In fact, there's the diagrammatic Monte Carlo method would be able to do that. And I think there's some interest now since we published that. And I guess there's some values coming up. I haven't seen those myself, unfortunately. So it's going to be interesting how the CL will compare to these values. What we can do, though, is to perform internal consistency checks. If we write it down, we have to satisfy those Maxwell relations. We have the cross derivatives have to basically align. And we can do this at fixed values of beta mu as a function of beta h, for instance. So every plot that we see here is a fixed value of beta mu. And the red line corresponds to the left-hand side, and the blue line to the right-hand side. And we see that there is a nice agreement between those two sides. So this should be fulfilled if our results are physical, right? All those dots are statistically independent runs, so they don't know anything of each other. So as long as this equation is satisfied, I guess it's a good sign. If it would not be satisfied, as it is the case here on these lower two plots, there's some issues. But of course, this is again connected to the fact that we have finite lattice sizes. All right, so these were all equation of state results. Now we can use this equation of state to get other thermodynamic properties, for instance, the compressibility. We can use this relation up here. So we take a numerical derivative of our equation of state, and we get, again, can compare to values from other methods. We have here, again, in blue, complex Langevin agrees with real expansion with the experiment, which is the red dots here. Of course, at low temperatures, there's some deviation, but we capture the feature of the curve. I have not shown the error bars of the experiment. They are also substantial here in this area, but I have not included them here. And there's also some values by Lattinger-Ward, which is a diagrammatic approach, or T-matrix. And we see we agree quite nicely. The T-matrix already deviates a bit earlier, but this is I don't know the specifics of the approach. But it seems that we do a quite reasonable job. And the reason one would look at this. This is the way that the balanced transition temperature, for instance, was studied, was that this quantity should have a peak or a divergence or at the phase transition. Of course, in our case, it cannot diverge because we have a finite system, but we still should see a rapid increase. And this is exactly what we see around this phase transition of 0.17 Fermi. And this is exactly how the experimentalists measured that. So we have a good agreement quantitatively up to the phase transition, and then above, that's only a qualitative agreement that we need to work on. Now, again, this is the balanced case. How would this change for polarized systems? I have it here in the plot. Note that this is a broken scale, so all of them would actually be on top of each other. And what we can already see here, that there's still the peak, but it shifts slightly to the left. But this is unfortunately everything that can be said. But this, it's really tough to get a good or precise value for the critical temperature from these finite size peaks or increases. So this is something that is smeared out and then it's kind of challenging to extract. And this is something that we are working on to get a better handle on. One would have to probably get a better observable, maybe the condensate fraction, for instance, to learn more about this transition temperature.
So you're looking at like across the solid black line in your phase diagram that you had some slides before, right? Which is the second order phase.
Yes.
There was also a dotted line, which that, is first order.
Yes, that was first order.
What happens when you approach?
No, because I can show you. So I guess okay. That's the one you're looking for.
Yeah.
So let me finish the sentence I wanted to have. So we see here the peak is still in the same area as the one in the balance case. So we see that there's not a lot of curvature, and it agrees quite well with values that we get from the functional normalization group. But in order to really learn something, how it would really be, we would have to do a better job. But the reason why we are not in this area is because you need to really have a high asymmetry. so these lines go straight up here. So if you go up here, you would have to have a really high mismatch in the chemical potential, and you would end up with the case where you basically have none of the one species and only a lot of the other species, and this is kind of too tough to do numerically. And we're working, we have ideas how to kind of address this, but this is quite challenging, it turns out. All right, but this is exactly what we're looking at here. All right, so that was the compressibility, and the last thing I want to look at is the spin susceptibility. So this is just instead of the derivative of the density with respect to mu, we can also see how the system reacts to an external magnetic field. And this is given by this chi here. Here on the left, we see the now magnetization as a function of beta h. And on the right, we see the susceptibility of a function of beta h. And it turns out, so these dotted lines on the right are now not the viral expansion, but this is the susceptibility from the non-interacting Fermi gas. This is at low field and low temperatures, often called Pauli susceptibility. And it turns out that the functional form of the spin susceptibility of the free gas and the unitary Fermi gas are quite similar, but of course, rescaled. And this quantity we can use to address or to kind of look into the question of the pseudo gap. And this is really the last thing I'm looking at. So this is what I mentioned before that we should disregard for now. This is really the question of what is going on here, just shortly above the superfluid, is there some sort of precondensation or of the type? So this would be visible in the spin susceptibility by a suppression. So if there's a pseudogap phase, one would have a suppression in the spin susceptibility. This is again for the balanced system. Here in units of the Pauli susceptibility as a function of temperature, that's a log scale here. And this is a plot that I took from a recent review by Jensen and coworkers. And I basically added in our CL results. And we see we agree quite nicely with all the theory curves here. There's a bunch of them, a lot of T-matrix approaches and Luttinger Void approaches and other AFQMC results. And all of them disagree with experiment. So that's interesting. I guess there's some work to be done. One has to say that the experimental measurements there have measured dynamic properties such as the spin diffusivity or the spin drag. And they related the spin diffusivity with some Einstein relations to the susceptibility. And I think maybe this doesn't work so well because It would be surprising if all the theory curves would be wrong. I guess that's the right crowd to say that to. But still, if you look closer, there's still some deviation amongst the theory curves. So some of them say there is a pseudo gap. See here the T matrix, for instance, some of them don't. And I guess the thing that we can say for now is if there's a pseudo gap, the T star, so where this pairing, the precondensation pairing would happen, is very close to the TC, but I guess that's all that can be said now. So it looks like there's no such thing, but this is something that is under active investigation, I guess. All right, so let me quickly recap. I think we all can agree that the impedance Fermi gases are challenging to treat, but we have now a way with the complexness Laugier method to address this to some extent, of course. But wherever values have been available, we compared and we see that the state-of-the-art methods are quite well matched. And well, we have shown that we can get equations of state and magnetic properties and as well as response properties for spin polarized systems in an ab initio fashion. And give you a quick outlook what we are intending to do. I've mentioned it already. We want to look at inhomogeneous phases with this finite center of mass pairing. We also want to address lattice fermions in 2D with finite polarization. Casey here is working on vortex formation in 2D bosons with rotation. And we also want to address the effect of finite mass imbalance on the pair formation. And with that, I want to thank you for your attention.
Thanks for the nice talk. Questions?
How much time does it take to make one of these simulations? So I'm asking because if there's no guarantee that this complex Langevin is going to work, what are like the main ideas that you have in mind before attacking one problem with this formalism? You might be investing a lot of time.
Yeah.
Whether it's going to work or not.
I mean, it's not crazy. I guess it's at the time scale what you need for with a typical AFQMC calculation that I think. If you look at this, at this plot, so this basically all the data points that we have, and I would say it's roughly in the so that the production data set I would say is 1 million CQRs, so 1.5. So it's not nothing, but it's also not crazy.
What are the lattice sizes?
This is 11 cubed.
Okay.
That was all with 11 cubed. You can scale it up. The implementation that I have done now is, I guess, quite vanilla. So there's no elaborate optimization going on, so there's still a lot of effort to save, I guess. But there's room for improvement. But it's a good method to kind of get some feeling for these systems. The good thing is that the polarized system would scale exponentially with a conventional Monte Carlo, but it scales in the same way with the CL. So there's no difference in polarized or balanced systems. So that's the good thing about it.
Your complex Langevin equation, you didn't seem to have the noise comfort or the Meissner part. Can you explain why?
Sorry, again?
You didn't have the noise term for the
Yes, that's an excellent question. Turns out it's numerically much more feasible to just use a real noise term. There, we have performed tests, and also I guess the lattice community have performed tests, and we came to the same conclusion. There's no elaborate mathematical reason behind it, but if we use a real term, the convergence is just much faster.
Just from empirical vision.
Yes. So one could write it down. One would have to satisfy that the sum, so the sum of the weights of the noise terms would have to sum to one. So we can just put any arbitrary noise. But if we satisfy this condition, one could also use an imaginary noise. But it turns out that the real noise is just more efficient.
So maybe that has to do with the fact that the original path integration for your auxiliary field is defined on the VR axis. Is that?
Well, if we write it down in that way, we have to define the path integration also at the complex axis, right? If we write a complex imaginary field, we also have to integrate out the complex plane, right?
Yes. Some.
But the idea, generally, the idea, if one would. Consider the path integral is that if we want to have a sine problem, there's only a real field to integrate. But in general, nobody says that this, where do we have it? This equation here, so the C here just has to be constrained to real phi. So this could in general be complex. If it cancels out exactly, it could work.
The phi in the first line.
Yes.
Is integrated over some contour, right? In the probably along the rear axis.
Yeah, no, that's really just the integration over all possible field configurations.
Okay.
And they could, it's probably written in a sloppy way, because if I write it in this way, I would also have to integrate over phi star. But these are really just the path integral over all possible configurations. That's not some contour integration.
So I'm confused. Suppose I decompose everything into real fields.
So yes.
If phi is complex, I have a real component and a real imaginary component, right?
Yes.
And then everything is defined along the rear axis of their value, right? And then do you introduce real and imaginary component in your complex Langevin equation for each real component of your original field?
Yes. I guess if I write it in this way, I also have to perform this integration over a complex phi. I mean, if phi is then suddenly a complex quantity, I also have to integrate the complex quantity.
For simplicity.
Maybe I don't understand your question.
For simplicity, let's say there's only one real variable. Your phi is only one real variable.
Yeah.
And then for that one real variable, you have real and complex variable in the Langevin equation. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
But wouldn't that boil down to the fact that I also then have to integrate out the
original phi? No, original phi is defined along the rear axis.
I guess if you think about it in the way of summing up, so in a Monte Carlo type way, summing up configurations of this path integral, then one does effectively do like this image or complex integration, because we also sum up the complex parts, right? That's average over there. Or maybe we can talk later. I don't know if I really understand the question.
For example, what if I treat the Ising model this way? I think that's basically what Sasek asks.
Right. So yeah, I would have to find a Haber-Zottonowicz transformation that represents that, right? So I don't know, for the Ising model, probably not. I've never thought about it in terms of the Ising model.
I mean, suppose I just have a right, I think model is a 5-4 theory.
Right.
But phi is a real number. I integrate that over. So I can cast that into the path integral form.
Yes.
Four.
Yeah, then I still, if the action would become complex, I would still have to amend it with an imaginary part.
So effectively, you're extending the definition of path integral.
Yes. So to some extent, you kind of extend the configuration space to sample all of them. Otherwise, you have different spaces, right? On the negative real axis and the positive real axis, if you have a sign problem. So I guess this is a way one could view that.
So effectively, if I do that, that will automatically convert the Ising model to a complex scalar problem.
Yeah, possible. I don't know. I would have to think about that.
And so you are looking at different values of phi, because we kept the original values and we still have those negative weights.
Well, the weights, in that case, I don't have a Metropolis step, so I don't care so much about the weights. I care about what kind of configurations here the Blanchard equation spits out. That's the main reason why we don't have to weight, so we don't have to do the Metropolis. So that's the good thing about this. So this is how it mm-hmm. works technically. Mm-hmm.
It doesn't work though, if you
would work if you have a real action. Mm-hmm. So the real Langevin wouldn't, or the stochastic quantization wouldn't buy you a lot in the terms of the sign problem. Mm-hmm. But the reason why we bother with it is because we might be able to extend it to the complex case. That's the main assumption. And it seems to work.
So in the 1D case, for example, you showed, of course, some cases where it didn't work. But even in those cases, for these small values of gamma, it was agreeing with other things.
Yes.
Do you see the difference in the histograms there?
If you take a closer look already, the histograms start to smear out and to show like these tails. But I guess it's still a statistical analysis, and if the effect is too small, it could just vanish in the noise. But I guess this would be the perturbative area anyway. But if you go far enough, you immediately see that this distribution becomes bad. You could also look at the distribution of the phi values in general, and then there's this branch cut, and this could lead to problems. There's a bunch of different ideas where this could come from.
All right, any other questions? Okay, let's thank the speaker again.